Just want to talk about my own perspective. First of all, my background is really not environmental law, so to speak. I don't consider myself an environmental lawyer. I consider myself a plaintiff's tort lawyer, which has been my experience really since getting out of law school after a brief stint with criminal law. But really, my background is just plaintiff's work, trying to put a case together representing individuals, usually in situations such as medical malpractice or products liability or general civil tort work. The type of work that I'm familiar with is in a small firm. I don't know what it's like to be, you know, in work for a Hale & Dorr or Foley, Hoag & Elliott up on the 33rd floor and 100 lawyers. I like, and I've always had the experience of working in a small firm with a few partners, working as a team on a case. And this case, the Woburn case, was certainly the biggest thing that happened in my life and had the most effect on my life in the years following it. So I could talk about the end and how I felt at the end and since then and some of the things to help the case get started in the beginning. In the end, when I think of the end, I think of when the final appeal to the Supreme Court of the United States, and that's I guess that's going all the way, the petition for writ of certiorari was denied. So there was nowhere left to go. I don't think you could appeal to the Vatican or anything higher than the Supreme Court of the United States. But when that signaled the end for me, my personal feeling was that I just wanted to forget about the case. It had been something in my life that had really turned my life upside down. It was, you know, certainly a meat grinder of an experience for me, and something to move past. And it's so amazing now with the widespread attention from the book and the movie that the experience a decade later is all coming back in such a big way and such a widespread way. And at the end, you know, from the personal I use the word devastation. Not feeling good about what had happened and what my life had become, as opposed to what it was before the case, when we had enjoyed success after success, we're enjoying each other, Jan, Kevin, and I, in the practice of law, as opposed to the end of the case, when it really eventually caused our breakup, our splitting up, and my own situation of being not having the same type of practice that I had before with a number of cases and success that we had. And these years passed, and there was an experience I like to talk about, which actually made me change my feeling years later, which is when I had to pick up a copy of the paperback, not having had one, hadn't read the hardcover when it first came out, and reading and going to the cashier and bringing the paperback up to her and having her say, "Well, you know, will that be all, sir? You just want this?" And I said, "Yes, I'll be all." She said, "Well, I've got to tell you, you're going to love this book. it's a great story." I told her I was somewhat familiar with the story. I said that I had lived it. And I told her I was one of the troublemakers that started this whole thing. And she said something to me that finally made me feel, you know, good about being involved in this situation, where she said, "You know, Mr. Crowley, I just want to tell you that I want to thank you as a citizen for working on that case because of my concern for the environment." So I finally came around to the feeling of, you know, feeling good about, although that the case was not a win, so to speak, and personally rewarding to me, that you know, I had done something, I had worked on a project that had contributed to a greater societal good, I think, in that, you know, the awareness that it's brought about with the book and the movie about concerns about the environment and changing practices of corporations and the way they have their policies and the way they treat hazardous waste, and they're much more careful now. And I think, you know, through our efforts and all going back with Ann, you know, really being the point person starting the whole thing with her dogged persistence, which is so admirable to me, that resulted in societal changes, which I finally felt proud of. So even though the case wasn't a personal success financially and in other ways, that I did feel good about that. So that's one thing that has brought my feelings around. And I'll just talk in a minute, Kevin. One of the things that people say to me is that, well, and I think one of the questions for the panel this afternoon is, you know, what would you have done differently? You know, a project of this magnitude for us, for a small firm, certainly very, very difficult. And I'll talk about the financing part of it a little bit, because that's portrayed in the movie, and Kevin and I, you know, taking loans by putting up our houses for a collateral, and that's certainly true. Was that Mr. Fasher, Jerry Fasher, says, well, we never had any idea about, you know, that we were running out of money and had difficult financing as it went along. And the Foley Hoag attorneys had said the same thing in another talk that we had given at Suffolk Law School. And I've come to believe that I believe them, that they're not really concerned about whether we had the financial ability to go the distance. Because I think it was a tribute to the front that we had put up. We had done it with a number of ways, with initial capital that we had from past successes and ability to borrow money and contributions of other people that had become involved in the case. I mean, when the case started, we didn't envision that it evolved to the size and scope, complexity, and enormity that it did. But it did evolve that, and it brought us along with it. We didn't set out to make it a cause versus a case, as was talked about a little bit in the movie last night with Michael Keating saying, well, we failed to distinguish between a cause and a case. I think it was a case, and it did become a cause, and I think that's, I disagree with him that's somehow inappropriate or wrong. I think our clients would agree with the fact that it became a cause, and that was okay with them too, because they're concerned about bringing attention to their problem, and it became a cause because it was so cutting edge, because nobody had ever tried to prove such a case like this before, and that was okay, but that's what it evolved to, and that's why when it started out as just Jan, Kevin, and I, and then it was involved trial lawyers for public justice, was a public interest law firm, and they became involved in the case, but really in the beginning they were going to have a more of a role, but we ended up with a larger role. Then it involved Charlie Nesson, that it involved the Terry Lenzner firm, which we had spent an enormous amount of money to try to investigate the Beatrice property and what was going on there, and involved James Gordon and that firm. So it involved, and it just evolved to this large undertaking, not through specific planning, but just it brought people along with it, and we were all in it together, once the commitment was there and made to this, you know, cause, there was no getting out, there was no turning back, and it was a situation where we were going to go all the way, because I think the tone was set early on that everything was going to be contested, everything was going to be contentious, and that once that tone was set, we wore that hat, wore the warrior's hat, as opposed to, I think as lawyers representing clients, sometimes you have to think about your other hat, and that is helping to solve your client's problems providing a remedy through the judicial system, because the judicial system, it's all they can do is give a money remedy. The system cannot bring the children back. A side effect of the judicial system may be that it will bring attention to something that will cause change in behavior, change in society, of societal good, such as increased awareness about hazardous waste disposal practices, etc. And that would be, an extra benefit. But in our roles as lawyers representing clients, we cannot forget about the clients and their cases and what we can do for them, which is in their best interest. So what would I have done differently? Well, maybe, as you know, the case started out with three defendants, actually, Unifirst Corporation, W.R. Grace, and Beatrice Foods. And as daunting as it was to have Grace and Beatrice and the counsel tables behind us, I think it would have been more daunting to have another law firm, probably the third biggest law firm in Boston, behind us at the third table. So we were able to get them out of the way, so to speak, in the beginning by settling Unifirst, and that helped also to finance the ongoing litigation with the other two. Maybe a strategy that could have been employed, as I think about it, is, you know, take them one at a time, rather than both at the same time, Grace and Beatrice. And if we could have gotten one of the other defendants out with a settlement somewhere along the line, that might have been something to do differently. Because, you know, that's subject for debate now. And then, you know, we could pursue it just against one defendant. So that's something that something to consider for something to do different. Before I turn over to Kevin, I was thinking about one question when they were talking about what the comparison of the movie to reality, and what are your thoughts about some of those scenes. One of the scenes that irked me the first time I saw the movie was when the scene where we're sitting at the hotel for the negotiation or the settlement demand to see if we could settle the case prior to going to trial, and John Travolta says, well, we want $25 million, and then we want $25 million more to study the health effects on the environment. And the actors playing Kevin and myself looked over at him like, what are you doing? Like, incredulously. That kind of irked me because that kind of shows that Jan was out on his own doing what he wanted to do, making a demand, and the rest of us not being clued into what he was going to do, whereas in reality, you know, we're all on the same page. Lawyers would never do that. We'd never look over at your fellow counsel and with a look of incredulous on your face saying, what are you doing? So that kind of irked me. Another thing that comes to mind is, you know, when Jerry, Rob Duvall, and Jan are in the corridor after, you know, discussing the case while the verdict's out. And he says, Jim, it's just me and you now. It's just me and you. I'm Mr. Beatrice. It's just me and you. I don't have to talk to anybody. Do you? We can decide things here. I mean, we're like kings in our castle, deciding the fate of others. Well, I know that's true because I think at the Hale and Dorr they have a requirement to call Mr. Fasher King. So I know that that's accurate. That's right. So some of my impressions. After Kevin has his turn, I hope we have some question and answer. You can ask us about our, you know, particular perspectives from our point of view. It's really from the small firm point of view, and trying to put a case together, which was near impossible, as opposed to a different burden, I think, on defendants is, you know, trying to, you know, tear it down. Say, no, that doesn't say what you said it says. That doesn't prove anything. That doesn't get you to the next step. You know, whereas trying to build something from nothing, certainly a difficult task. But I'll turn it over to Kevin at this point.
You know, one of the unfortunate things about this meeting today is that it's over at 11 o'clock. I'm sure we can talk about, we could be talking all day about the Woolman case, about any one issue. You know, my name is Kevin Conway. I come from Everett, Massachusetts. I'm one of nine children. And we used to sit around the kitchen table and we used to talk. I kind of look at this as sitting around the kitchen table talking. As a matter of fact, you should know some of the people in this room with you. Some people very instrumental in the Woolman case. As Bill said, Ann Anderson is here. It all began with her. Jerry Fasher is here. Jerry was the attorney for Beatrice Foods, the trial attorney, the one for Beatrice Foods. Zig Plater is here sitting next to him. Zig was involved at the end of the case, in the brief to the, her biggest brief to the Supreme Court. Mike Keating is also here, trial attorney for W.R. Grace during the case, sitting as he should beside Mr. Fancher. No comment. But you have a wealth of people here, and Jonathan Haar is also here who put all this together and is largely responsible for the reason that we're all here. As Bill said, I'd like to leave some time for questions, and because you have all these wonderful people here, I would invite you to ask questions to anybody, but you have an opportunity. So think for the next 5 or 10 minutes about what you might want to ask on any subject about anybody, people here, or people who aren't here. Like Schlick. But let me give you just a little thumbnail sketch of my involvement in the case and my background. I went to Notre Dame, I went to Georgetown Law School. I consider myself a very ethical and idealistic attorney. I've always felt that way about myself. It's something that I wanted to do in my career, to do the right thing. Coming out of law school, I seem to have always been involved in movies. Coming out of law school, I worked for something called the Waterfront Commission of New York Harbor, which was a crime commission. And we saw the movie on the waterfront starring Marlon Brando. At the end of it, there's a little scroll saying the Waterfront Commission was set up to eliminate organized crime from the waterfront, and I worked for that commission helping to eliminate crime from the waterfront. And after I'd done that, I went to work for CBS. I worked in their corporate legal department. I was counsel for CBS News, for the radio and television networks. I got a real good inside look at how corporate thinking is, how to make judgments. In my estimation, by the way, of how corporate lawyers make judgments is that it's very ethical, it's very sound, they try and do the right thing. But being one of 9 kids and growing up talking about all these issues, I guess I needed a little variety in my life, so I gave up all that and opened my own practice. In Belmont, Massachusetts, just opened the door and took whatever came in, and what came in, if you do that, if anybody wants to do that, it's crimes and divorces and real estate and wills. I did that for a couple of years. And then I had a friend, Joe Mulligan, who said, why don't you come in with me? We're a great plaintiff's trial injury firm, and we're going to do great things. So I went to work with Joe Mulligan and Barry Reed, and Barry was working on his book, The Verdict, which would eventually become As We Were There. The second movie I was involved in, Verdict. and I literally edited chapters, and the director came up and sat down with us and talked to us before the movie, and we were really involved, much more so in The Verdict than we were in Civil Action. we met Jan Strickland when there was an airplane accident, and Barry Reed represented 2 people on the plane, and Jan represented the 3rd person on the plane. And Jen and I worked on this case and settled it, and that's how, our relationship began. And, a couple of years later, Bill was there at the same time. Bill and I worked with us on cases, and we decided to go out and open up our own firm. We had a string of successes. We were the hot young firm in town. We were knocking them dead. We were settling cases. We were winning cases. We had everything, right at the top of our game. And it was controlled. We got a method. We did mock trials on every case we did. We did them over again, mock trials over again. We really tried to test. We needed to know the answer to what was going to happen before we heard the jury speakers what was going to happen. And so we used that method. And other attorneys were looking to us. And they were asking for advice on things. And then the Lubin case came along. And that was a case that, in truth, I did not want. We were very sympathetic with Ann and the families, but it was a case that I simply didn't think that our firm could do. And we had lengthy discussions about it, and literally it was a make it or break it with our partnership from my standpoint. I said, if we do this, we're not going to survive. And Jim had some sympathy for me, but he had some sympathy for the families too. And we never would have taken the case, except for 2 things that happened. One was this public interest group, trialist with public justice, came along and said, this is a wonderful case, and we're going to make a statement for the environment, and we'll help you. We've got lawyers across the country, smart lawyers, Ralph Nader, guys and women that can really help you out and get money. So that happened. They said, let's go for it. And the other thing that happened was the statute of limitations. It was running out. in May of 1982, or at least we thought it was for some of our clients, and that combination led us to file a suit. What happened was
we're going to be local counsel.
Yeah, we were going to be local counsel. That's a tried case. And I knew we were in trouble when we sent them the bill for the filing fee. We had 33 plaintiffs, so it was $3,300, 100 each. We sent that to trialists for public justice, and they said, we haven't got that kind of money. $3,300 for the filing fee, they didn't have that kind of money. And so they were gone, and we were there. And the rest really is history. Just in broad strokes. For me, it was devastating on many levels, each of which I'd be happy to talk to you about, but I really don't have time to do it today. It was devastating for me on a financial level. It was worse than the book movie describes. And, I'm looking at the movie, and at the end, this is, you get back to even when you settle the case. And that wasn't true. We weren't that even. We were so far in the hole that Jim went bankrupt, and Bill and I have been trying to recover for the last 12 years. And I don't think that either Bill or I are back today to where we were before the Wooten case. So on that level, certainly, it was a loss. And our locker room broke up. In the movie, we abandoned Jan, and it really wasn't the way it was. Jan abandoned us. After the appeal to the Supreme Court, Jan said, I can't do it, I don't want to be a lawyer anymore, and he left. He left us with considerable debt, and he says, but I can't do this, I don't want to be a lawyer, I want to sell light bulbs. And that's what he did. He went to Hawaii and he sold light bulbs for a while. But for Bill and me, the story continued. And so it continued for a long time after that. We didn't go bankrupt. We paid our debts to the extent that we could, and we're still paying our debts. And it was also a loss of a lawsuit that we think we should have won. And we had won every case up to that time, and this is the first one that we had lost, and we were so deeply troubled that it was something from which we weren't going to recover on a professional basis. And for many years, Jan selling light bulbs, and for my own story, I felt equally discouraged, but I had a family and two young kids, and still did a family and two young kids. And, we had to go on and support our kids. We couldn't go to Hawaii and go bankrupt and let the pain wear off under the sun.
It's still on the agenda.
It's still on the agenda. We'll get there someday. But I've been Jonathan Haar's book, the first person that I heard about the book from was Mark Stoller. I was playing miniature golf with my son in Bar Harbor, Maine, and Mark Stoller came running up to me and said, hey, Kevin, have you read the book? I said, what book? He said, Jonathan Haar's book. I said, Jonathan Haar. Now, this was 1995, and the last time I had seen or heard from Jonathan Haar was 1988. So Jonathan disappeared from the face of the earth. It was a distant memory. And he said, boy, some book, he said. I said, is it out? He said, well, Grace got an advanced copy. I said, okay, can I borrow it? So I don't think there's any left. He said, well, ask Jonathan, maybe I'll get you one, too. And he said, boy, he said, lawyers don't look too good. He said, lawyers look pretty bad. He said, Kevin, I got to tell you. He said, Grace has decided to turn this into something good, and they're going to become a model corporate citizen, and so something good has come out of it. And that was the first inkling I got that something good maybe is coming out of it. And I've been talking to people about the book as everybody involved in the case has been. I've talked to book clubs, I've talked to libraries, I've talked to high schools, I've talked to universities, I've talked to law students, I've talked to the incoming class at Holy Cross, the incoming class at Brandeis, I've talked to Yale Law School, Harvard Law School, all these law schools, everybody wants to talk about the book. And you say, why? And why is that? And why does everybody want to talk about the book? What is it that they want to talk about? Is it that something grabs them deep inside that says, I identify with a fight against the system. Maybe there's a system out there that's not quite fair to little people. The children from Reuben who were screaming in the night and weren't getting answers. Maybe there are people that identify with them, the people who don't feel like their wrongs are addressed by our society. I don't know what it is, but everybody wants to talk about it. And now's your chance. So how about some questions? And I'm going to invite you tonight to ask anybody in this room anything. This is a chat. What do you want to bring back with you? What are you thinking about?
I'm going to ask you how you feel talking about this, given who's in the room. Your personal feeling, that if you're a lawyer, this is your business. This is his. But this is much more than that. And you've dedicated yourself professionally and personally. How you feel in this room with the people against whom you were working, as a result of whose work caused all of this loss in your life.
So you
want to hear that one?
I have a lot of respect for the lawyers in the room, Jerry Basher and Mike Keating. They're fine lawyers. I understand as a lawyer that your job as a lawyer is to represent your client zealously as best you can within the ethical boundaries and the rules of the court. This case brought everybody into, again, this war mentality that Jan talks about and that I agree with, and that's the tone that was set. I think that we disagree on the meaning of things, but I can't just as a person or as a lawyer, hold something against these gentlemen personally. I can't do that. I don't do that. I think I respect them, and it was a war, but the war is over now. It's a decade has passed. We'll always disagree about, the meaning of things that went on in the case. Like, for example, I would say this thing about Beatrice and Riley being separate and having separate counsel, Beatrice and their counsel not controlling Riley or the evidence coming separately from Riley as to Beatrice. I think we'll always disagree about that. I think they were so intertwined that their defense was a common defense, and I think we'll always disagree about that. That any claims that we don't know what Riley is going to do and we can't control him, and if he's going to put monitoring wells on his property, we can't control that. But that's not discoverable in the federal litigation. I think that the and who had it, and should it have been produced, should it have not been produced, would it have made a difference in our case? I think that those questions I don't think will be resolved, and opinions about that will differ forever. When I read the affidavit of some of the Nutter McClellan Fish lawyers, Fishman Ryan, that said that, we understood from Hale and Dorr that if Riley puts monitoring wells on his property, that could generate data. That data might be harmful to Beatrice's case. So that if he does that, he would be on his own with respect to the indemnity agreement that we have, because Beatrice had sold the property back to Riley but retained the liability, therefore, and also are they paying Riley's lawyers. So Beatrice is paying Riley, Beatrice is paying for their own defense, for Hale and Dorr, to us on the other side. They are so intertwined that they are together there, and that what the court called deliberate misconduct in discovery and withholding the document is attributable to Beatrice, and by saying that, well, we can't attribute that to us because we're separate from Riley. Riley's here, we're here, and McClellan's here. But, I will disagree with that forever.
Yeah, just a quick comment. I like and respect Jerry Basher. I like and respect Michael Keating. I like and respect Ted Cheeseman. Do I feel like we got our day in court? No, I don't. I don't feel like we got our day in court. Certainly, Ann Anderson doesn't feel like she got her day in court. And maybe this is our day in court today. Maybe this is, we sit around, maybe this is finally our day in court. But it is with some feeling of, I do feel tension sitting with the other side. I can like them and feel tense, and I do it every day with my wife. but it has left us with lingering questions, and you know that's part of the reason we're here today. Yes.
Has this changed the way you deal with clients, or the way you communicate with them, and litigate a case on their behalf, in terms of your relationship with clients?
No. No, I'm not quite sure what the question is, but when I came to the Woburn case, I had been an attorney for many years. I was the old person in the group. I was older than Bill. I was older than Jan. I had many jobs. I was really the experienced, wizened, old mentor type, despite my youthful appearance. And I had many clients. I had my own little office, and I feel like I always dealt with clients the same way, and that was with we're together. We always had. A real bond, a real good communication, I feel like in the Woburn case, we had good communication with our clients also. We met very constantly. We were always talking about it. I thought we were always on the same page. It was more than a legal team. It was a team of us and all the families. We wanted to do something. We really wanted to make a difference with this case. It hasn't changed the way. I hope I'm still communicating with my clients the same way. The Woburn case was difficult. There was so much. Just so much happening so fast, day after day, and so many people involved that it gave us communication problems that you don't have in a normal one-on-one case. But I don't think it's changed the way I deal with clients. I hope not. Bill?
No, it hasn't changed. I believe in the open policy of openness and honesty and telling, keeping clients informed what's going on. I think that, a lawyer's role in representing a client, it's like we're an airline pilot. We're flying the plane because we have the know-how to fly the plane. The client is the passenger, but the client is the paying passenger. The client ultimately says, or should say, where the plane goes, although the lawyer is the pilot. So that's the way I look at it. It's the way I approach relationships with clients, with openness.
Yes.
The book suggests, Juarez, that the real tragedy in the case was that you ran out of money, that you could have pursued the case against Grace after the jury verdict. And that raises questions about trial lawyers for public justice's pullout and your response to it. You said two questions about that. First is, didn't Griceman have some kind of responsibility to the court having signed a retainer to stay in the case? And how did he deal with that, or how did he get out of the case? And second, once they were out of it, did you try to get a large law firm with considerable financial resources to substitute for them and help them counsel in case that you were late to get the counsel you wanted to get?
Yeah, those are excellent questions. Trial lawyers, it became obvious to both trial lawyers and us that the case was simply beyond their capabilities. And they disappeared. They literally disappeared. It was fine with us. They disappeared at the time. Unfortunately, they resurfaced at the end of the case. And they were quite angry with us because, in their opinion, as in our opinion, we had lost. And they were quite critical of us. And I think I'm very unfairly so. It's something that, is not discussed like that between us and trial lawyers, and it has not been for a long time. We had we borrowed. How do we survive financially as long as we did? We borrowed money from a bank. We had loans and paid them off, and we had good credit. We had houses to put up, which we did.
Why didn't you get a big firm in?
There is no big firm in the country that would bring anywhere near us. There is a big firm, a small firm, any firm. If you're representing Beecher Schools and W.R. Grace, the firms will line up. If you're representing eight families from Woburn, please. There was no chance. What we did have is we had contributions from friends of ours. lawyers who are friends who gave us money, loaned us money, without notes, nothing, just gave us money because they knew the situation we were in. And we borrowed from Uncle Sam. You know, we borrowed a lot of money from Uncle Sam, which, you know, caused a lot of our problems. But you think you just like go out and go to the locker room and say, oh boy, there's lots of money here, let's say, get involved in this.
The other book like this is Buffalo Creek Disaster, where Arnold and Porter takes the risk and does the plaintiff's work, which they've never done before, and invests 2 years of its time and money, and ultimately wins. Did you search for firms like that that would have, that might, chances are not, that might have.
Even the Lentner firm, they were referred to during the trial as the so-called Washington fact-finding firm. They came in and did an incredible amount of work, but unlike us, they weren't on the risk. They did an incredible amount of work for being paid all along, and they were paid an awful lot of money to do their work, regardless of what the outcome of the case would be. I guess when it comes down to, you know, contingency fees and contingent work on lawyers, I mean, it just came back to Jan, Kevin, and myself on that.
We've not looked for firm. That's the simple answer to your question. My sense is that no such firm existed, but we did not actually go out and look.
Can I just, the second part of your question was a pretty interesting one, which I never thought to ask, but I wrote about the events as they unfolded. This is hypothetical. Had you had the money, unlimited resource, or somebody paying you an hourly rate, would you have pursued the case with the verdict that you had against Grace?
No, we couldn't. This is an untold story. The reason we couldn't is because of the results of the jury. We're very inconsistent with travel times. It had put our clients into a hopeless complex, and we had no choice at that point but to resolve.
There was at that time some real talk about this, so
we explored it like we did everything. We sat down, we fully weighed all the options, and you know, at that point, had we had a lot of money, I don't think I think we still would have tried to resolve it much more quickly. The case changed dramatically after the verdict. It was not the same case. We not only had lost outright against Petrus, but we had been severely damaged by the verdict against Grace. Yes, I agree.
I think a lot of us have told Jonathan that he's created a classic for the last 20 years, like Buffalo Creek, though, but even more. But I think over time, students, and in our book, we separate between the two plaintiffs, between the two defendants more and more. You got some money from Grace, but most people looking at the story, I think in retrospect, will say Grace was probably a very minor contributor compared to the tannery. The movie doesn't make that distinction. Jonathan makes that distinction, but it seems to me over time, when Jerry says, hey, the jury saw the case and they found Grace liable and my client not, that, it seems to me, touches your frustration. Because it's not the Grace case that you could have spent that money on to appeal, but if you could have done more on the Beatrice appeal, that would have given you a sense of vindication. I think against the land, according to EPA, that's far more contaminated than any other land in that area.
Well, that's true. The levels on the 15 acres were much higher than the levels of Grace by multitudes. We always believe that Beatrice property was a major contributor to the contamination. That would have been the thrust of our argument, had we won the appeal against Beatrice, but we lost it. So, you know.
Not even the appeal, but just winning a trial, just winning the basic question of the contamination traveling from the 15 acres to the wells. There was, the Abergeona River, much was made of it. It stunned me to read. I was reading an interview with one of the jurors who said that, I couldn't understand how the contamination could have gotten past the river from the Beatrice property, only 300, 600 feet away to the wells. And I said, it was just stunned me because we put on this million-dollar presentation to show that it went under the river, Harriet, under the river. And it just goes back to the problem of, you know, trying this case, such a highly technical case, to ordinary lay jurors that sit there for 78 days in a sometimes hot courtroom, where you know, some people are falling asleep during this such a highly technical presentation.
I comment on that, and on Zig's question, which I think is entirely asked backwards.
I've heard this before.
Yeah, well, maybe you'll learn now. I say it enough, you might understand. But first, I want to say one thing about these two gentlemen in front of you. They are terrific lawyers. I never had anything but the utmost respect and admiration for both of them. They were doing the day-to-day work. They were grinding out the motions. They were preparing the experts. They weren't holding television conferences. They were back there doing lawyers' work. I never had a cross word, a mean word, with either of them. They were straightforward, and we both had respect for each other. And I don't think they've had a cross word or a mean word for me. And that's the way lawyers should be, as Shakespeare says. You strive mightily as adversaries, but eat and drink as friends. So I have nothing but respect for them, and that will continue, and this is not the first public confession of that. But I do think, number one, if you look at it as a trial lawyer and not as a professor, the case against Beatrice was a weaker case. And the strategy was, and the correct strategy was, to knock off the defendants one at a time and use the funds from one settlement to fund the other, which is certainly a strategy I would use when I have used when I was a plaintiff. And the Beatrice property, 15 acres, as we all know, was contaminated. It's not a big secret. The EPA was there before these gentlemen were there. It was a Superfund site. So that was not the question. The question was responsibility for the contamination and for contamination during a certain period, because these dates happen to be important. So I think their strategy was correct. And I think their concentration on Beatrice was probably not well-founded in terms of tactics, that a lot more, and it was, and Beatrice, as Kevin and Bill know, was concentrated on very late in the game, the last month before the trial, was when Lenzner came in. So that I would have, and we're all asked, what would we have done differently? I think I would have reversed the concentration. After all, I was have the case started all against Beatrice, as you know, I mean, the actual trial. And it was, whether geologically or morally or whatever, the case was more difficult against Beatrice to prove. And the trial lawyer always goes for the strongest case. And one of the things that went wrong somewhere was that you and I, and I'm talking about the two of you and I, could never talk, and we never felt that we could reach across, and actually it was the looming figure of Jan that I couldn't reach across, because Kevin and I have the same philosophy about settling cases. You call, and Bill too, you call each other up, you say, come on over, let's have a sandwich, let's have a drink, and we settle. So that, somewhere that took a turn that wasn't very good. On Bill's point about the document and about the relationship of Riley and Beatrice, we of course hashed all that out. It was your view prevailed, and then we had 23 more days of hearing. So we went through 78 plus of days of trial and 23 days of hearing, 3 more days of argument, about 115 days. And we did go into every aspect, almost every aspect of that part. And it came out, again, unfavorably, the findings of the judge, which was interesting to me, the idea that from Jan's own files, the judge concluded there was no case. But as far as the strategy was concerned, I think somewhere along the line, you knew, because you and I talked, and you come over to the office. So you know there was some money available from Beatrice at some point. The number may not have been high enough. But that never got pursued, and maybe there were internal discussions that I don't know about as to what happened. But you were certainly inquiring about me. You know I'm a settler, I believe in settling, and you probably are too. And maybe you can tell us.
Well, we're running out of time here, but I really would like the last word. This is so good. This is so good. This is, first of all, as far as our trial strategy goes, we will face, we had a problem settling with you, Jerry, because the contamination numbers on the 15 acres were just so high. They were so high that it would have been very easy for Michael Keating to, if you were trying against him alone, to just point over there and say, this is where it's coming from. It made sense. It was coming from the 15 acres. A tidal wave was coming from the 15 acres, and dribs and drabs were coming from W.R. Grace. We had the contamination against you, and we had the dumping against Grace. We didn't have the dumping against you. So that's why we couldn't settle with one of you, because, first of all, Grace, we didn't think that they really wanted to settle with us prior to the trial. They thought they were right, which, as it turns out, I'm sure they still do. But we were very afraid of going against just one. That's number one. And like I say, our weakness was because we didn't have any evidence against Petrus Foods dumping. We didn't have that until after the trial. Now, you talk about these documents, and the documents to me are not major, but John J. Riley going out and cleaning up the tannery site before the EPA came in is major. That is the one thing that we didn't have that would have made a real big difference. And that is what we gave to Judge Skinner, who, looking at that same record, found us, the plaintiffs, guilty of misconduct, found us guilty when we were following the mandate of the First Circuit Court to carry these hearings, and then he said, okay, you carried it on too far. So, this is the heart of it from our standpoint. And that's the way it ended. It ended with us, the plaintiffs, being found guilty of misconduct for carrying on a case too far that never should have been brought in the first place. Bill Cheeseman was right. He was right in 1982 when he made that motion. It's a frivolous lawsuit, and that's what Judge Skinner found in 1987. It was a frivolous lawsuit, and maybe that's why people are upset. So I'm upset. Bill, any last word?
I think your comment, Jerry, about the trial strategy taking a turn so that we never sat down to try to work out the case is true, and I think truthfully it's a function of the tone of the case, which is a function of the way Jan set the tone of the case. And I think Jan now talks about that. That's one of the lessons he's learned, that if you want to solve somebody's problems, going all out war to destroy them and be declared the ultimate victor is maybe not the way to go about it every single time. And he talks about that as a lesson that he's learned. But at the time, and we're trying to transport ourselves back into that time frame and the mindset that we had, we just never put that hat on. We just never put that hat on for whatever reason, and it was kill or be killed. And I think the lesson that comes out of this is you have to always keep in mind, keep your eye on, as you say, the medical evidence, Michael, is coming down the road as the plaintiff's lawyer representing clients, real people in their homes whose this case is going to affect for the rest of their lives. You have to keep an eye on what's in their best interest and what is your power and ability to do something about bringing about a result that will be in their best interest. Because, your power and ability as a lawyer in a cutting-edge case like this in this context is certainly limited. So you have to remember to do what you can do, which is in their best interest. Fighting this war, although now it's become historic of some proportions, I hope that lesson does come out of that. Yes, Michael.
I certainly don't want the last word, but I do have a question that gets a little more specific to what we're talking about now, because I think it's so important. I'll say just
very quickly, this is not my question. I absolutely adopt what Jerry said about Kevin and Bill personally, and I won't repeat it, but I think they know it.
Hey, you repeat it.
Because I've always felt that way. I think everybody in the great scheme felt that way, and it feels that way today. The question I have is this. When that jury was out for 6.5 days, they reported deadlock. I will say, from our point of view, the longer they were out, the more confident we got that we might have a chance of prevailing on the hydrogeological phase. Because when that jury went out the first day, I can tell you from my point of view, it wouldn't have surprised me if they came back an hour later and said that they had found that our contamination had reached the well for 100 reasons. I didn't think it had, but that was my disposition. That jury was out for 6.5 days. They report deadlock. Now, at that point, at least in my mind, you have the risk of a new trial being ordered by Judge Skinner, although he sent them back for further deliberation. If there had been a new trial, number one, which was one strong possibility at that point, but an equally strong possibility was that both defendants were going to be exonerated, because I think certainly by this time we began to think that we might be, you would have been left without even the settlement that you were able to garnish after the trial. What were you thinking about during that time period when I think you were really quite in peril?
You know, we had, I told you we had done mock trials on the Wolven case, like we did mock trials in every case. We'd actually had 6 juries deliberate. And they all came out the same way. They all found in our favor. And obviously they weren't given the sophistication of the evidence that the actual jury saw. But we just didn't believe we would lose. We simply didn't think we were going to lose on that phase. We thought that was the easy phase of the trial. I guess hindsight's 20/20, as they say. And looking back, maybe we should have considered the risk. But we didn't. We simply didn't think we were going to lose that phase.
Right, and you could talk about the decision to go with the 6 unanimous versus the 13 out of 15. Certainly, in hindsight, and we had much discussion internally about that decision. And Kevin has some strong feelings about that. I think when we all the people involved internally voted which way would be the safer way. I think we all felt 13 out of 15 was the safer way. Jan felt that he could control the front row of the 6. There, you know, he saw something in the stars or something that these 6 are with us. But I think that I've come to learn that we had 5 out of 6 right from the start. And as you say, if the questions weren't so complicated, if it was just did they do it yes or no, check off yes or check off no, I think they would have been back, you know, day one with the.
Introducing
two of the plaintiffs in the Woburn case, Donna Robbins and Danny Tooman. And they had some untold stories that I think that you will be very interested in learning about. And so I'll turn it over to them and ask them to begin at the very beginning, how the case actually began, and then open it up for questions that you may have. So, Donna.
So, do you want to go from when the case began, or how we all got interested or involved?
How did you get interested in that?
Well, with me, it started, Ian Anderson and I went to the same church, and her son, Jimmy, was diagnosed before my son, Robbie, and she had suspicions of the water being, you know, the problem of the leukemia in her neighborhood, and when her son was diagnosed in 72, mine was diagnosed in 76, he was 4 years old. And she and the minister had been working together on, you know, trying to figure out how many cases in her neighborhood there were of leukemia. And, you know, when my son got sick, Bruce Young had come to me and asked me, you know, if I thought it might be the water. And at the time, I really didn't think much of it, but then, you know, when I had got home and started thinking a lot more about it, I remembered how I used to boil the water for formula, you know, long after we didn't have to boil it anymore, according to the doctors. But I didn't trust it because it smelled bad, tasted bad, and I didn't want him to have it in the formula being bad. So I thought that I was doing a good thing by boiling it. Also for, you know, cooking food. And, you know, time went by and in 79 they discovered the barrels up in North Woburn, Northeast Woburn. And from that they tested the water wells and found that there were contaminants. And so, you know, that was written up in the local newspaper and things just started to blossom after that. You know, people got involved. We formed a faith organization. It was called For a Cleaner Environment. And we had quite a few members of that, probably 25, 30 members maybe. And at any given meeting, there probably wasn't more than 20 people there at a time. But as far as the actions went from the group, we were pretty powerful. The city government, the, you know, state government, the federal government, everybody was kind of fearsome of us. And so we did a lot of stuff in a short time.
What kinds of things were they involved with that got the attention of the government agencies?
They, you know, we tried to find out who was responsible for contaminating the wells. You know, not much happened with all of that, I don't believe. The faith organization helped for get into being the cancer registry and the super fund, you know, cleanup fund. And, you know, I had gone down to Washington, D.C. to testify. Anna Bruce had gone down before me, and Anna and I had gone down another time. And which wasn't really fun. It was kind of my first big experience being in front of a crowd that's scared to death. And it hasn't changed either.
During this time, Donna, were you doing this by yourself? Was your husband with you? How was your family composed of?
Well, Robbie, when he was he actually wasn't diagnosed for like a 3 month period. He had some bone pain in July where I couldn't walk overnight. And so I brought him to the hospital. They aspirated the hip. At this time I was married, but there were some problems going on. And, you know, the doctor that aspirated the hip, and I'll tell you now because it's going to fit in later, cut the sciatic nerve and left Robbie permanently damaged with, you know, a foot drop and You know, so he had to wear a brace and his shoes and a cast every night of his life that he lived. And already in the 5 years of his life of the leukemia, his that leg was about an inch shorter than the other one. And atrophied. When Robbie got out of the hospital when he was first diagnosed in October, because we went through the whole summer with him having bone pain, and they kept testing him, nothing showed up until October. You know, I was going through a separation at that time, called it off the day before Robbie was actually diagnosed. And the doctors in the hospital knew that there were problems, and they said if it didn't work out, don't stay together because it's not good for the kids. You're better off not having, you know, that stress around. So we decided it wasn't going to work. We, you know, separated. Didn't do a divorce for a year and a half because we needed time to think about it. Was it doing the right thing? And more or less, I went through it all by myself. You know, made all the decisions and everything. Eventually, the doctors at the hospital had, you know, sort of encouraged me to find, legal action against the doctor that cut the sciatic nerve because they said it never should have happened. You know, the coordinates that he went in was not the right area for him to go in to make the incision, and therefore he cut the sciatic nerve. So eventually, I did. I called the attorney that handled my divorce, and he in turn knew somebody who did personal injury cases, which happened to be Joseph Mulligan, and Jan Shulkman worked with him at the time. Joe Mulligan handled the case for almost 5 years, was in Ireland a lot. He was a very nice man, very grandfatherly. I thought he was wonderful because I knew nothing about lawyers. And every time I'd call to see where things were at, he would say, well, you know, these things take time. And never really got anywhere with it until Robbie was so sick. This doctor that did the injury wouldn't settle because he knew that, you know, there would be no money awarded, you know, for a dead person. And in the end, I got enough money for his funeral costs. So that was how I knew. Eventually, being a member of FACE and not seeing things move quickly is how I got involved with GM, the lawyer that handled my divorce. And recommended me to go to Joseph Mulligan. He called one day to see how we were all doing. And had asked if, you know, I had ever thought about going after or finding the companies that were responsible for contaminating water. And I gave it some thought after a while. And I called Joseph Mulligan, and he came out to speak to Bruce Young and myself at the church. And from there, we gathered the families, you know, sent out a letter, I think, in the times that the families had received, anybody who was interested in doing something to come down and meet with him. And Joe Mulligan came down, I think, one time, didn't he, first time, and then after that, he sicked in on Jim. And I was kind of glad because he'd still probably be in Ireland and nothing would have happened. So Jan did come out eventually and talk to the families and told us up front, you know, that he was in it for the money and the fame and the fortune. And,
he wanted to be famous and good.
Yeah, and he did in the end. we encouraged him to, keep the case. And knowing that it's going to be very costly and very hard for him to fight because nothing had ever been done like it before in the world that we knew of, and nobody around ever would have taken this case on. So Jan stuck it out and learned as he went along, more than being concerned about the money and the fame and notoriety, he got very concerned with the people that he grew to know. So it was more of a personal fight then. Plus all the stuff that had gone on in the courtroom, you know, all the misjustice.
Mary, could you tell us how you got involved in the case? I know that you also suffered a tragic loss of child first and then Patrick.
Yes, yeah.
Tell us how you got involved with Donna.
Yes, Patrick was my son, and my husband's name was Richie. My son was diagnosed on August 15th, 1979 with leukemia. He got repeatedly struck throats, and then when he was on the antibiotic, it didn't seem to, the last time, he was still sick and he wasn't, you know, recuperating. So we took him to the doctors, and then the doctor seemed upset, and he sent us to the Winchester Hospital where he was diagnosed there. And then we were told to take him into Mass General to Dr. Truman, who was also Ann Anderson's son doctor as well, and Kevin King's. And he went in there, and I remember the doctor saying he didn't think he was going to live that weekend. He was so, the leukemia had taken such a hold. We knew it was getting weaker, but that kind of really upset us naturally. And whatever treatment they did give him, I thank God for my faith, because I know I went and prayed hard, because I said to the doctor, I'm not going to take that for an answer, that he's not going to make it. I had already lost a child, a four-year-old, in a car accident, and I just couldn't believe this could happen to me again. So whatever happened, the doctor did say to me, God had to intervene because they didn't think he was going to make it. Well, God gave him back to us for 19 more months, maybe to get used to, but we weren't going to have him. I don't know. You know, we don't know. And it was a rough battle, 19 months up and down. You know, he was doing good. He wasn't doing good. You know, we used to hate to go in to see the doctor's face because we knew, you know, the answers wasn't going to be good if he came with that long face. You know, we'd say, oh, I remember my husband one time, he was so upset. He just put his fist through the wall because he said, oh my God, because it was a situation where they put him on a medication and they said that, you know, they would put him on for a couple of days and he'd do good. You know, they figured. And we went in to see him that night. He no longer had the medication. And we said, oh, he must have, you know, something must have come up. We were thinking, good. And when we saw the doctor, it wasn't good. And there was a young intern, and they told us that, had, you know, Patrick was his case. And they said we had to take him out with a sheet because he got you know, attached to Patrick and caring for him. And when I think back on those days, I'll tell you. But then it was in that early September, this was in August, that we took him in, that there was a notice in the Times saying that anyone who knew of anyone that had leukemia or had a child or family member to come down to Trinity Church in Woburn. And there we met Reverend Young and Ann Anderson and Donna, and there's other mothers and fathers there as well. And we just, you know, said we'd meet more often to find out if we could, you know, they wanted to know when they were diagnosed, and they asked us a lot of questions and things like that. And as Donna said, they came around to a court case, and then Jan Schlickman came on the scene, and I can remember him coming in and didn't think he could do anything about it. Like Donna said, it was kind of a long, drawn-out thing, waiting, you know, to see if what was going to happen. You know, we knew we had set that someone was going to do something about it. And finally, when he came, I remember it was in Bruce Young's office that he just didn't think he could do anything. And somebody mentioned trial lawyers for justice. And he said, oh, I belong to that. And he said, oh, I'll look into that. And so he did, and things started slowly coming about from then on. And then my husband got sick after that. It was in, because as you say, that we had the court came out in 86, the case was settled, so to speak. And then my husband got sick in 87. He just went for his regular physical, as he always did, and the doctor checked his jaw. He found a lump, and he had to go in, and the doctor said it might be because he had melanoma in his arm, and I did too, same arm, but some physical. And the doctor said to me, it might be the melanoma back again, or it could be another type of cancer. I go, you're kidding. I said, he said melanoma 9 years ago. So there's no way to come back after 20 years. So when the doctor called after the initial surgery, he said, well, I got good news and bad news. It's not melanoma, but it's another rare type of cancer, adenoid cystic carcinoma. I said, he had his adenoids out. He said, adenoid means tumor. So that was another 2 years of another horrible situation. We were going in twice a day to the Cox Building in Mass General for radiation, morning and afternoon. He had to have it in his jaw. And then he seemed to do good for a little bit and then went into his bones. And that was it. And so all the men in the family are gone. So my two sons and my husband I have an older daughter now that has two children, which are the joy of my life. The little guy reminds me of Patrick, especially his smile, you know. And she has a little girl now, too, and I have a younger daughter that was here last night, too. You know. As a matter of fact, when Patrick, before he died, he said, he was the baby. And he said, Mom, I think you better have another baby. And I thought, oh, dear God, he thinks he's dying. And about 3 or 4 months after he died, we found out we were having another baby, and I brought her home on his first anniversary of his death. Unbelievable. Well, thank God for my faith, because that's what keeps me going. I don't like to look back. I like to look ahead to see what's going to be, you know, and I know I'm going to see them again. God is true to his promises. I believe that.
Anybody else have a question?
My name's Lewis. I'm interested in knowing whether you feel satisfied with the degree to which Jan integrated you into the decision-making in the case. Whether you felt like you were partners in the case, or whether you felt like he was adequately looking out for your interests without involving you, or whether he wasn't even really looking out for your interests, and I don't mean that in a great sense. I mean whether he got lost in the details of litigation and lost that of the client sometimes. Especially in terms of various settlement offers that may have been floated earlier, and whether or not you knew about them, whether you think that Jan should have told you about them.
He, from the onset of him taking on the case and really getting involved, doing his research and everything, there was a period that he was sort of making contact with Ian Anderson, and you know, the family, you know, I hate to say it, weren't really getting informed, you know, because the conversation was between them a lot. And we had a meeting at one point, and you know, I offered for him to make phone calls to me, you know, on a daily basis or a couple times a week, just to keep us up to date of what was going on, which he did, and then I'd call all the family. Mm-hmm. And if there was any new information, he was very good about getting it out to us for the most part. I'm sure that there were conversations that he had, you know, that he didn't feel necessary to have to call us every hour on the hour to let us know what was going on.
An important time, so he had us come into the office and he had a board and he was explaining, you know.
We made a lot of trips into his office,
yes,
and he also made a lot of trips out to Woburn to keep the families up to date. So, you know, I can't say that we were at a loss of what was going on. We knew right along pretty much.
And the hardest thing he was also allowed into the courtroom. I think
yeah, we couldn't go in the courtroom, but even at that, you know, he sent out daily transcripts, you know, and set it up to be like 8 transcripts for each family. And every family would get them, but as the finances dwindled, there were less and less transcripts that came out to the house, so we would pass them along and everybody would read them. And trying to keep up to date, which was hard because they'd be like, you know, 200, 300, 400 pages, you know, double spaced, one sided. It was easy reading, but, you know, do that every single night. It was hard to keep up with a lot of it. So a lot of times we would just skim over, you know, some of it.
Richie was good at it.
Richie was really good at it.
Really cool.
We depended on Richie for, you know, being our spokesperson.
He also went to Washington, too, didn't he?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, he did. He went with us.
Were you aware during the case of some of these earlier episodes where Jan Joseph had made financial offers that he did not accept? Or did you learn about them for the first time in the book?
No, he had told us a couple times, I think. I don't think there weren't a whole lot.
No.
And even if he had brought it up to us, I don't think the families would have gone far because it was, you know, we wanted to get into the courtroom. We wanted to get to the second stage, whatever you want to call it. So, you know, having to settle wasn't really, you know, in the cards, so to speak. I think maybe more their concern because money was getting low. You know, that they would have brought a big offer or gone far in the beginning, but in the end, I don't think it would have made any difference.
Thank you.
and the $20 million offer in the movie was never sold. So,
that's probably
right.
That wasn't true, no. Yeah. There's a lot of fiction in the movie. It's very good movie, but there's a lot of fiction. Larry. I admire Jim and I appreciate the work that he and his partners did.
Mm-hmm.
You had to be there in his office to see the amount of work that they all did. It was just incredible. They had, every wall that you walked around, every corner in that office was full of boxes of woman
dedication,
and big posters and stuff that they use for evidence in the courtroom. To be honest with you, I don't trust many people.
Mm-hmm.
I don't trust the
court.
I don't trust the court. I think that's totally it's a one-sided affair.
Almost like a gameplay.
I really don't trust the judicial system at all, and I don't think I ever would. My divorce went through. That was uncontested and easy. That was the easiest thing I ever did. As far as bringing suit upon anything, I don't think there's any justice there.
Mm-hmm. I feel the same way, too. But the truth didn't really get out.
I think the government lies. There's no truth in that. Riley's property has been built on. There's like four new companies that sit on that property, and I know that it was never tested before it was built on. And the mentality of the city of Woburn is that, if a company comes in and they'll put a sidewalk in, they'll let them put it in there. They'll let the company build. If they want to put streetlights up in the corner. Anything the city can get out of somebody, they'll let it happen and turn their head. And, you wonder if there's any payoffs that happen. Why they can't stand on their own 2 feet and object to something being built, until it's tested. But I know it wasn't tested because nothing would probably be built there right now.
My name is Alan. I'm just curious, I think I recognize you from the movie House of Trials. Love Canal was a big news item.
Mm-hmm.
I just wonder if you have any recollection of that and if it had any resonances with what you were experiencing.
I was aware of it at the time and knew about Lois Gibbs. The difference was that Love Canal didn't have any deaths from the illnesses that their kids had. And, Woburn did. And actually had the cluster, too many kids close together. Lois deserves a lot of credit for all the work she's done and what she did back then, getting the waste, out in the news. But it was limited, and I think that when Woburn hit the news because of the deaths and the cluster, it really made a whole lot more publicity. Whether it attracts people, because children are dying, I'm sure it does.
It is important.
It's scary.
Yeah.
And God forbid that it would ever happen at Love Canal, too, or anywhere. The phone calls that we get now from all over the country is just phenomenal. The people that are dealing with, contamination and waste and water and companies that are polluting, and, they're city local officials that are just overlooking, situation, or somebody's trying to get the judge. It's like Woburn all over again. And if you go in on some of the websites, regarding the civil action, I've looked in to a couple of the responses. People say, I live in Woburn, so, oh, I'm going to go see who this person is, you know. Come to find out they live in a whole other state, but it sounds just like Woburn. So, and, you know, and I refer a lot of people to those kids.
Mayor, I wonder if you can remember any residents list.
Yeah, I remember that. Yeah, I remember. Well, like Donna said, there was no debts there, but I know they all had to move out of the area. I remember that. And I remember they had a struggle as well to prove that there was something wrong. That's my recollection. And all those kids did come through Lessons in Woburn. When we had the premiere that night, she spoke. Quite a speaker. Yes. Yeah.
She's come a long way.
Yeah.
I was invited to go to California. I can't even count the years back now, but at least 10, 12 years ago. And, you know, but she was there too. And, you know, she's very dynamic. You know, and she can get up there and talk and, she's got quite a big organization and has helped a lot of people.
I'm
going to ask you a question. What I've always asked you to
begin
with
is, was
there any
community
behind you, and
how did the rest of the community
feel?
And you,
yes,
to
make sure
you support
someone else. They were apathetic. Yeah. I didn't say too much. I mean, you didn't get anything personal. You know, nobody said anything. I just said, wow, you know, they were amazed that we were doing that, probably. But
they were more concerned with property values at the time.
Well, the city was. The city was, you know, they were kind of upset about it, you know.
That was the main thing. They didn't care about kids getting sick.
Yeah.
They didn't try to correct anything. They sort of harassed us when we had the face meetings at the church hall. The police department would be out there ticketing cars. You know, because the parking was poor.
Yeah.
But, you know, you would think that you would have support from them, but there wasn't much. And there are a lot of people. I mean, my own family were doubtful that this was really the case, that it was the woman that caught us with leukemia. And, you know, so you don't even talk a lot. I didn't talk a lot to my own family about it because it was like I didn't feel like taking on the grief of that.
Yeah.
You know, but the mothers, I mean, Mary and the rest of us, you know, could talk
together. Yeah.
I mean, she knows how I feel. I know how she feels. And even Ann, you know, when Robbie was first diagnosed, I was never able to go up to her in church when Jimmy was sick. And I can remember them sitting in the church and him with his little bald head. And, you know, you just didn't know what to say to somebody who had a child with cancer. You know, until my son was diagnosed and he came up to me and it was like we just looked at each other and I knew then what she felt, she knew what I was feeling. And, so there's a lot of support, you know, with the mothers. Mary's probably pulled us all through a lot of it with her face. Really, she's a fantastic person.
Oh, thank you, Johnny.
But she'll get repliant for these little things.
Hi, Steve. I have two questions. The first is this, I'm not sure how to ask this, but what did you have to do about presentation and the little joke of the introduction when one of the attorneys was introduced and he objected, you know, because Charlie among most of the attorneys. What's on a personal level, how do you feel personally to the attorneys who represented the other parties? I'm sensing that you don't feel that substantive justice was done in this case.
Right. Yeah.
Can you divorce it the way we're taught to divorce it, or can you not divorce it?
I just feel it's their problem. I went up to Mr. Thatcher at the premiere and I introduced myself and I said, my name is Mary Tomey and I was one of the mothers. And I thought he was very uncomfortable. Yeah, he didn't even want to look at me. You know, he just kind of just trying to see if he was looking around, you know. I don't have any problem with that because I feel like it's the truth.
You can see the guilt. I really do. I feel like he feels guilty.
Yeah, but now that's what I feel.
He was so nasty to him. But, and I had talked to him a couple times too, out when they were filming on the set once, you know, I introduced myself and you know, he was all appreciative, and we had a nice conversation before. I got a lot of digs in, and I felt good. You know, and then at the premiere, you know, I had walked up to him, sort of didn't want to talk to him, but was standing beside him. He turned around and says, "Oh, hi, Donna." I said, "Oh, boy." You know, and we were talking again, and he said, "I'm really not a bad person." The whole time he can't even look at me. I actually finally took a picture of him and me talking, and I'm looking this way, he's looking over that way. He cannot look us in the eye and talk. And after seeing the film last night, I was starting to feel okay about being around, but the film last night, it brought everything right back, you know, that saying that the families were in it for the money. The money I wanted was to compensate my son for being permanently damaged the rest of his life. You know, had he lived, he would have needed it. You know, it's never going to bring them back, you know, and for him to be so adamant saying that that's what the families were in it for, you know, it's just infuriating. I mean, everybody wanted to see, who was responsible, paid for it, you know, and learn from it and clean it up, which is never going to happen. You know, somebody said that the wells would be, the aquifer there, the Abidona will be cleaned up in the year 2009. It's never going to happen. I'm telling you, it will never happen because EPA, the DEP is not there monitoring all these companies, you know, that are dumping. You know, it's just never going to be clean. So, no matter how much these companies ever would have had to pay, even though they're paying $70 million now to clean it up, I suppose $70 million makes me feel good, but it's just a drop in the bucket for them.
At what point, and why did you become really convinced that it was the water that was the cause of it?
After talking to Bruce and Ann about it, Bruce is the one that brought it up to me after church one day. You know, and it gave me something to think about. And I can remember back when I was a teenager, going back to that point when it was my turn to wash the dishes, you know, fill the sink up with water because who had dishwashers then? We had four girls, so it took turns. And I can remember vividly, as a matter of fact, my other sisters were outside playing basketball, and, you know, we were on a dead end street. And here I am standing there washing the dishes, you know, and the water smelled. And so it brings you back to points like that, you know, and then going onward. And when I met my husband at the time of, you know, when I first met him, he had come to womb and took a drink of water. And almost the first thing he said was, "Oh, this water is horrible." You know, it was just disgusting. He was from Alabama. You know, and I didn't even know really or remember what clean water tasted like till I had gone down there to visit.
The water in my house changed drastically. We moved in there in 1963, and we had people, you know, visiting, and they told me how great the water was. It's just like spring water. They said, "This water is delicious." The same person came the next year, 64, and took, it was in the summertime, and took a drink, and she said, "What did you do to your water? It's horrible." And she spit it in the sink. My dishwasher started turning brown inside the door. When I went to cook with the water, it all foamed up like when you were cooking potatoes, and brown foam on the top. The clothes were dingy when you washed them. You know, the pipes started leaking in the cellar. You know, those things were just corroding, you know.
I've heard those comments, but if I understand correctly, I think all those problems with the water don't have anything to do with the fried
chlorine. No, as a matter of fact,
the of the water that...
You're right. It was the bacteria that was in the water. And they did write in the paper a couple of times that there was a high bacteria count in the water, and that's what we were smelling most likely. And that, you know, they would chlorinate it to try and take care of it and everything. But it wasn't. And you boiled the water so that you thought you were killing the bacteria, you know, which maybe worked for the bacteria, but it didn't work for the chemicals.
the TCE and, you know, whatever else. There's a lot of other things in there.
But it's not just that I'm trying to get at those things that we need to do other suspect, aren't treated in the end with things they had any, presumably had anything to do. So, I mean, one could have said, well, I think it's exempt in the water. So.
Well, until they tested the water and found these things in the water, you know. What really started, it was somebody dumped barrels of waste near the train station, and Charlie Ryan, I believe, is the one that said he thought, geez, he said, well, G&H wells are nearby. He says, you know, you better have that checked. And when they checked, they found these other chemicals in there. You know, they found organic, too, but they found the heavy metals and things like that, you know.
And was there any thought that it might be or contamination, or
it was ear testing too. They all kind of
tests. You know, I mean, there are a lot of things.
If you saw where the wells were, too, really in a gross area.
Yeah,
I couldn't believe that they even dug in there.
They give them a bad feeling, but in fact, they're all
around. See, I don't think we were sure of that, though.
In the beginning, anyway. But it
just made a lot of sense to us that, you know, there's so many people sick and everybody drank that water. You know, that everybody had the problems with the rotted pipes and, you know, and as you got further out in Woburn, away from the wells, there was less of a problem.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you didn't have as many people having the rotted pipes, you know, in the brown clothes.
And there was different wells, too.
Well,
the one wasn't on the same wells that we were running on. Yeah. So it was all in the same area, so it was all young boys, you know.
When I mentioned that it was a gross area, it's an interesting thing that I went to the field trip to Woburn to see what it was like, and you sort of get the sense when you read the book that you have greatest need for this meeting in the first, but there are so many different institutions there that could have been, including, was your anger directed really towards Grace and Beatrice, or throughout the entire thing, did you think that they share responsibility with others? How confident are you that they are the ones rather than all the other ones who contributed to contamination?
In my mind, I felt it was Riley, because he was right up the street from us, and when we moved there, he used to have even pile his hides on us, you know, at the end of my street. There was another lot there, and the smell was gross, and even the animals, the dogs or the cats, would get into the hides and drag them around, and, you know, yeah, take pieces. It was awful, you know, and then their property, too, and of course, they had all those chemicals right there that were just probably pouring right into the ground, you know.
And there was Abizona Auto Parts that I'm sure contributed to it.
The barrel company.
And the barrel, Whitney Barrel, a Woburn Barrel, I forget which one it was. What, Murphy?
Murphy's Oil?
No, them too. But who was the barrel company?
Whitney.
Whitney. Yeah. Mm-hmm. You know, and my brother-in-law used to work for them, and they used to dump stuff down a drain, so. I think there were a lot of people that contributed to it, you know, and I think it was more or less we left it up to the lawyers to, you know, find out who was most responsible. Riley's 15 acres, which is down below his property on, you know, the opposite side of the railroad tracks, was dumped on quite a bit. You know, he let people go in and dump there.
I thought it was interesting to read that a lot of the workers in Riley came down with leukemia. There's a fellow that I met recently that said he was from Italy, but he said he worked there for 6 months, and he said they had this big vat that they used to put the skins in and hang them up, and he says, oh, my hands were burning and everything. He said there was something in that. There was something in that, obviously. He goes, yeah.
As a matter of fact, the hairdresser where Mary goes.
Yeah.
Oh, him, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, he was he remembers all that stuff.
Yeah.
And it, as we go along after the case is all done and settled, you know, we run into people that, you know, reminisce about all of that, and they remember that kind of stuff.
Mm.
I've had patients come into the hospital that I've taken care of, you know, and they always want to know where you live. So I live in Woburn. Oh, yeah, well, I know Woburn. They used to jump over there.
Yeah.
You know? And it's like, where were you when we needed you, you know? So, and people, you know, the other men that had hauled stuff out of there, you know? So,
My husband said, they asked that question, he said, well, where would you go? He said, it's been, tested more than ever before. And he said, well, if we move, will we move to another toxic waste site? At least we know what's going on here.
It supposedly is monitored very closely.
Yeah.
And we're
not on the wells anymore, thank you.
No, we're not, but even last year, it being monitored closely, there was a well closed down, a Horn Pond well, with trichloroethylene in it. And, my neighbor's cousin's daughter, who I'm sure was fed by those wells, because they live in the southern end of Woburn, she came down a few months ago with leukemia. So it's like, who's the next victim? How long was that well on service and how often do they monitor it in between? Is it every 6 months? Is it every 2 months? So maybe if it's even every 2 months, if the trichloroethylene is in there. There's enough people to get exposed to it. It doesn't take much, to set one cell off in your body to cause it. So at one point somebody had said to me, this was years ago, and I might be totally wrong, but they had said that, a tablespoon or two is all it would take of trichloroethylene to contaminate, half the city of Woburn. And I don't know how true it is. But I know sometimes it doesn't take much to do that.
How do you feel about the book?
I thought it was an excellent book. It's more to the point, a lot more than the movie.
So did the book get out the things that you wanted to get out of the lawsuit?
I think it told just about everything. It's actually, I'm sure Jonathan has stuff on the cutting room floor too.
Yeah, he did.
That he had to cut out that we would have wished to have seen in there, A lot of people that we talk to all the time now, especially with the movie, wanted to see more and hear more about the families, But when Jonathan wrote this, it was to do with the lawyers, in the judicial system. And that's what the book is about. But the book is excellent. It's done its job. I've got phone calls from throughout the country, and actually a couple, one from England, one from Canada, and there's another one too, I can't remember where now, but people have read the book or even have heard about the case. In one instance, there was a woman from Utah that had called me, and she's taking a statistics class. And my name came up in the statistics class. But I never did anything to deserve it. But she called me, and she found my phone number, however you look it up. And was telling me about her daughter had leukemia, and that's why she was taking this course. And there were a few other kids, and there's a campsite there, and the book has made itself known. I mean, magazine articles too. Years ago, I forget what magazine it was in now, but I regret doing this, but I took this person to the cemetery and he took a picture of, Robbie's gravestone. And, I really felt pressured into doing that. I didn't want to do it, but I ended up doing it, and I have a lot of regrets about that. But from that magazine article and somebody reading the name on the stone called me, looked up my phone number.
Wow.
So it gets around. People will find it one way or the other.
Well, you had a
question.
No safe place.
Yeah.
I don't think so, because
Oh, yes. Okay.
I mean, it's interesting.